From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The battle for the Yemeni Red Sea port city of Hodeidah continues. Thousands of residents fleeing the fighting between the Houthi rebel defenders and pro-government forces backed by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. The port is vital to both sides, for the rebels supplying the capital Sana'a, for the government to end the three-year conflict. The UAE Foreign Affairs Minister is Anwar Gargash.
Our estimate is anywhere between 2,000 to 3,000 fighters. Militia, not in uniform, majority work in small groups, snipers, with heavy, extensive use of anti-personnel and other mines. Many of these mines also are Iranian-made.
Gargash describing the strength of the Houthi defenders. As for the assaulting force,
we have coalition forces and we have also Yemeni forces of various brigades that are working there, and that we do have numerical superiority.
Dozens of civilians have reportedly been wounded in the fighting. Gargash said the port remains open for urgently needed supplies. The fighting is centered around the city's airport. Gargash said he hopes the UN envoy, Martin Griffiths, might be able to arrange a Houthi withdrawal from the port city. Niger's foreign minister said the International Sahel Military Force is achieving success despite a lack of funding.
La Force G5 est devenue déjà une réalité.
Kala Ankaraou promised funding of $480 million at a Brussels donor conference in February has not yet been deposited, but the force is fighting, he said, concretely on the ground against terrorists and jihadists. The so-called G5 Sahel Force fighting alongside French troops in the tri-border area of Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. This is VOA News. President Donald Trump has ordered creation of a new branch of the military to focus on space. He said it isn't enough to have an American presence in space, but to have dominance there.
My administration is reclaiming America's heritage as the world's greatest spacefaring nation.
He would need congressional approval and funding for such a space force. It's the latest attempt by the president to revitalize the U.S. space program since shuttle missions ended in 2011. In December, he signed a directive to enable astronauts to return to the moon and eventually develop a mission to Mars. Turkish and U.S. soldiers have begun independent patrolling around the northern Syrian town of Manbij, following an earlier agreement to resolve a dispute about the town taken from Islamic State by U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters that Ankara calls terrorists. Under the deal, the YPG militia will withdraw, and Turkish and U.S. forces will maintain security. At least two people were killed Monday as environmental activists clashed with Gambian security forces in the town of Fariba Banta, some 50 kilometers south of the capital, Banjul. Activists have demanded closure of the Julake sand mine, alleging it causes environmental damage to local farming land. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo Monday said he expects to meet again with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un following last week's historic summit in Singapore between the North Korean leader and President Trump.
There's a lot of work between here and there. My team is already doing it. I'll likely travel back before too terribly long. There's a great deal of work to do. We still have to flesh out all of the things that underlay the commitments that were made that day in Singapore. I was there in the room with Chairman Kim. It was the third time I'd met Chairman Kim. He has made very clear his commitment to fully denuclearize his country.
Pompeo, addressing the Detroit Economic Club, said Mr. Trump has committed to altering the existing armistice, ending the Korean conflict, and providing the North Koreans security guarantees. The goal, he said, is to reduce one of the world's greatest threats. Meanwhile, the U.S. and South Korea have agreed to suspend joint military exercises scheduled for August. Such drills have been criticized Pyongyang as a prelude to invasion. At least one person is dead. Several have been rescued among 80 passengers aboard a ferry that sank Monday at Indonesia's Lake Toba. Dozens are unaccounted for. In Britain, Parliament's upper chamber, the House of Lords, rejected the government's divorce plans from the European Union. Britain plans to leave the EU by next March. The vote appears aimed at giving Parliament a greater voice in the exit process. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, June the 19th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. 8 Kenyan personnel were killed in an attack by fighters of the Islamic militant group Al-Shabaab Sunday in northeastern Wajir County. The area has been a frequent site of attacks by militants crossing the border from Somalia.
They started shooting at them, and then they killed all of them. Only to leave one who was still alive, but we are bringing him to Wajir Referral Hospital. He succumbed to the injuries on his way.
Isa Ahmed Abdi is a member of the Wajir County Assembly. Malawi's former president Joyce Banda says she is prepared to lead the opposition party's PP in the next election. The former president is currently on a nationwide consultation tour to speak with Malawians about seeking the nomination of the opposition party. And Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni threatens to crack down on media houses that are critical to his government.
Donate to the people of Aga Khan. Aga Khan, who's getting a lot of money from here, must stop. Otherwise, I will do something about it. There is a radio called NBS. That radio is always telling lies.
That was Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni. And in Libya, the country's Coast Guard said they have recovered the bodies of 5 African migrants and picked 191 survivors off the coast west of the capital, Tripoli. Stay tuned. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's World Cup update is coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Libyan Coast Guard say they have recovered the bodies of 5 migrants and picked 191 survivors off of the coast west of the capital, Tripoli. Libya's western coast is the main departure point for migrants trying to reach Europe by the sea, though the number of crossings has dropped sharply since last July. The 5 migrants were brought back to port in Tripoli on Monday, along with 115 survivors from various sub-Saharan African and Arab countries, the Coast Guard said. 8 Kenyan security personnel were killed in an attack by Al-Shabaab fighters on Sunday in northeastern Wajir County. The area has been a frequent site of attacks by militants crossing the border from Somalia. Raya Rombour reports from Nairobi.
The incident is said to have occurred around 2:30 p.m. on Sunday. The security personnel were on patrol when they were attacked near the town of Bojigaras. Authorities said the car the security officers were traveling in ran over an improvised explosive device. After the explosion, Al-Shabaab fighters opened fire. Isa Ahmed Abdi is a member of the Wajir County Assembly.
They started shooting at them, and then they killed all of them. Only to leave one who was still alive, but we are bringing him to Wajir Referral Hospital. He succumbed to the injuries on his way.
Authorities say after the attack, the militants fled towards the Somalia border. Ahmed said locals had expressed their concern about an impending attack, and the information was passed along to the security forces to no avail.
It could have been prevented because the public have actually given a first-hand information that these elements were there, and these elements themselves also said that they are going to do an action that the people will regret.
Northeastern Kenya has been the site of some of Al-Shabaab's most deadly attacks. In December 2014, the group killed 38 non-Muslims at a quarry in Mandera. In April 2015, gunmen stormed the Garissa University College, killing 148 people and injuring more than 100. This is the second Al-Shabaab attack in the county this year. In February, militants killed 3 people at Kasa Primary School. Al-Shabaab has targeted Kenya in retaliation for the country's involvement in AMISOM, the African Union force in Somalia that backs the federal government. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Even though agricultural produce on the continent has continued to grow, this due to factors like urbanization and better access to markets, the agricultural system across the continent remains inefficient in the way farmers profit from their produce. And one of the reasons is due to the middlemen who fix prices and monopolize trading. A new blockchain platform, the kind that runs cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, seeks to append that system. This new platform, known as Binkabi, is developing a physical agricultural commodity trading network with the aim of decentralizing agricultural commodities, cutting out middlemen in the process of trading agricultural produce so the farmers can make more profits from their produce. I reached the founder of Binkabi, Quan Lu, in London and asked him how this platform will work.
So even though food are produced by millions and millions of farmers in this market, but when it comes to exports, there's only a few big companies handle most of the exports, because fundamentally people across different countries don't trust each other, so they have to go through middlemen. However, by providing trust, the intermediaries actually take out quite a lot of profit, meaning that there's less for people in the supply chain, particularly farmers, to benefit from their own production. And another major issue that in the international trade is the reliance on US dollars.
Mm.
So every trade involves two exchange rates, exchange conversions, and every time you do that, you can lose easily between 7 to 10%.
You lose value. So together, you lose value for your commodity.
Absolutely, between 7 and 10% of the value of the commodity is lost to multiple exchange conversions. You can lose up to 10% if you are just going to middlemen who are just providing back-to-back trade.
Okay. So who's going to be able to use this platform? Are farmers in the villages somewhere in Africa going to be able to use Binkabi?
So for Butterflock, what we are looking for is we really enable SMEs, small medium companies, to be able to export directly. So people who are aggregating cookies from farmers, and normally they will have to go through other intermediary in order for them to export. Mm-hmm. But with Butterflock, they can export directly. So people who are ordinarily not able to export, now they can export directly because they can find buyers from the other country. For farmers who will be ultimately beneficial of the Binkabi platform, we have another proposition called tokenization of commodities. So the way we do that is we ask farmers, or farmers can go to one of the accredited warehouse, have their produce to be graded, to be weighed, and then once they have done that, they will be issued with a warehouse receipt. We will digitize the warehouse receipt and have them traded, so the farmers can actually sell their commodities or their warehouse receipt to a wider
who sets up this grading system, and what is the basis for the grading system for these farmers to be able to get their tokens?
Actually, you just mentioned a very important issue, which is commodity standardization. Because in this market, let's say you are calling from America. In America, when you trade on CME or, Chicago Board of Trade, you have a very clear standard in terms of grading for the commodities. In Africa and in Asia, we basically have to create the standard from scratch based on the trading practice. But basically have a common standard that people can recognize. So the buyers, when they pick up the tokenized warehouse receipt, they know exactly what kind of quality they are buying into. And that also forms the basis for the liquidity of the market, because without having a common standard of quality, then it is very difficult to be traded.
What do you hope that farmers benefit from Binkabi by cutting out the middlemen?
So in East Africa, there's a very good use case for commodity trading in Ethiopia Commodity Exchange. So when they set up this formal marketplace, what they found is that farmers who export coffee from Ethiopia ordinarily only get about, before the exchange, they only get about 30% of their export price. But after the exchange, they get up to 70% of the export price. So that is basically double the income that they received before. And this is the power of removing frictions in trade. And you know, farmers, not only that they don't have to go through middlemen when they sell internationally, but also they know to produce high quality goods so they can get more for their produce.
Quan Le is CEO of Binkabi, a rich team at his home in London in the UK. Journalists in Uganda say that they will continue to do their work despite their president's threat to crack down on media. President Museveni, in a recent speech, threatened to deal with private media houses in the country who print stories critical of his government. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
Donate the people of Aga Khan, who's getting a lot of money from here. Stop. Otherwise, I will do something about it. There is a radio called NBS. That radio is always telling lies.
That is President Museveni talking at an event in Kampala last Thursday. He referred to some media houses that report negatively on his government as evil and stupid. Robert Sempala, the executive director of Human Rights Network for Journalists in Uganda, a local media rights watchdog, says he's concerned with the president's statement.
Such words of the president bode a lot on our safety and security. These overzealous people might want to appease the president and then descend on journalists and start beating them up. It might incite violence against journalists and media houses. So we must really be alert of the implications of such statements of the president. And this is a message we're passing on to our colleagues, not to take lightly the president's statements.
Solomon Silwanja works for NBS, one of the popular television networks in the country, agrees.
You expect that managers who will be perhaps responsible for managing the administration and the financing, they'll be coming down to manage the newsroom, and that is very dangerous for media houses in Uganda. There will be self-censorship.
Last year, editors of Uganda's popular English tabloid, The Red Paper, were arrested and charged with different counts, including publication of information, prejudicial security, liberal and offensive communication. Red Paper editor Alinito Rugendo says the arrest left them traumatized. He says there are now some stories they prefer not to publish for fear they may be arrested again.
You can't freely report what you think is the best for the country. And then we are beginning to move into a situation where you're reporting like you're in a cage, you know. You're not free to report all the stories. That certainly has an effect on the general practice of journalism in the country, a negative effect.
Serwanja says journalists too have a role to play in national development and promoting democracy in the country.
I think for a young democracy such as that of Uganda, it's important that the media plays a critical role without any fear from the executive, the judiciary, and the legislature.
According to Reporters Without Borders, which ranks the performance of media freedoms across the globe, Uganda is now ranked 117th out of 180 countries, 5 places from last year's rankings. Journalists here say they're engaging the government to grant them the freedom to report freely on issues that affect their nation. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
We go to Malawi, where the country's former president Joyce Banda says she's prepared to lead the opposition People's Party, PP, in the next election. The former president is currently on a nationwide consultation tour to speak with Malawians about seeking the nomination of the opposition party. The former president recently returned home after a 4-year self-imposed exile in the United States, following accusations of corruption during her administration. Last week, the former president held meetings in the capital, Lilongwe, with the aim of forming an alliance ahead of next year's elections. Leaders of the opposition PP have argued Joyce Banda to seek the party's nomination for the elections, saying that she stands a better chance to defeat the incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika in the presidential vote. The party has yet to set a date for its convention to choose a candidate to represent the group. And for reaction to former President Joyce Banda's readiness to lead the opposition People's Party, VOA's Peter Cloti reached a parliamentarian Noah Chimpeni, spokesman for the opposition party in Malawi.
Yeah, of course, well, what she said yesterday is that she would be contesting at the convention. So if she's chosen at the convention, then she would take up the mantle to represent PP at the next general election.
But do you see anybody in the PP, the opposition party, challenging her for the slot of leading the party to the presidential election, particularly when she's been dominating this party for so long and represented the party in the last election she lost?
Yeah, of course, as of now, nobody has come forward yet, but you never know. This is a democratic country. Somebody can come up and say, I want to contest. So as a Democratic Party, anybody's welcome to do so.
Realistically, what chances do you see for the former president from challenging incumbent President Peter Arthur Mutharika in next year's election, looking at the advantages that the president has, including the power of the incumbency?
Of course, if it were to be a free and fair election, then she has got a huge chance because of what people are saying on the ground. They're very disgruntled with the current government, and they're remembering what Dr. Joyce Banda did when she was president in 2 years she was in power. So she has got every chance if the elections were free and fair.
Some are suggesting that why wouldn't the PP join forces with the biggest opposition party in the name of the Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, to defeat Peter Arthur Mutharika, because both of these parties have the same aim to remove the party legitimately from power.
So, yeah, of course, there are those calls from some quarters, but we'll listen to them as they grow louder, we'll listen to them. But currently, we are working as People's Party, we're not working with any other party.
So far, what has been the outcome of the recent meeting the former president had with minor political parties with the aim of forming an alliance to boost their chances of posing a threat to the current president in next year's election?
We are still talking, but what we encourage the other parties that they should work as individual entities, so that at least the current government should face fire from every other direction that fire can come from.
Now, I understand the former president is touring the rest of the country, meeting people, talking to them. When does she complete this, and when do you expect the convention to begin to choose a new leader or choose a leader to represent your party in the presidential election?
I'm not sure when she'll complete this. I don't think she has set a date of when she'll complete, because some of the country is it's big as far as the population is concerned in terms of the topographical. So it may take a little while. The convention, convention is a one-day event. You can name a date today, and tomorrow you have a convention. The bigger task is the one she's doing now.
Well, as the spokesman of the party, how has the former president been received in her tour, interacting with people across the country?
It's very unbelievable. It's very encouraging. That's why some of us are even encouraged that she should start, because we never thought it would be like this. But the turnout in almost every meeting is very good. Of course, we're aware that people turn up in political areas. Not all of them are your supporters, but that's a start. Because when you've got people to tell your message to, then it encourages you that there's a chance here.
Is her message resonating with people?
Definitely, it is. It's doing that, obviously.
Parliamentarian Noah Chimpeni is the spokesman for the Malawi Opposition People's Party, PP. He spoke to VOA's Peter Cloti from the capital, Lilongwe. And now for some World Cup updates. As the tournament enters its seventh day, Samson O'Malley is covering the World Cup on location in Russia Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, Jackson, and welcome to our continuous coverage of the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Russia. And for today, I'm at the Luzhinsky Stadium in Moscow, Russia, where I have with me some journalists from Africa. It's day six of the FIFA 2018 World Cup here in Russia, and exciting goals, fantastic matches we've seen so far, but the same cannot be said of the African teams at this tournament, whose performance can be described as anything both dismal. I have with me some journalists who are covering this tournament from different parts of Africa. I'd like to ask them to introduce themselves and tell me what they think about African teams at this tournament.
My name is James Onyango from Daily Nation in Kenya.
I'm Robin Toskin from the Standard newspaper in Nairobi, Kenya.
I'm Fred Kawesi, New Vision, Kampala, Uganda.
James, I'd like to begin with you. What do you think about the performance of African teams in this tournament? Four teams so far have had their opening games and none of them have won any of their opening matches.
I think the going so far has been very turbulent for African teams. The first four teams all losing their matches in the tournament. Maybe when Senegal play the next, their match, then probably they'll come up and try to, you know, revive Africa's honor. But so far, it's been very gloomy for African teams in this tournament.
Well, as Jim says, it's really been gloomy, and the performance has been far from impressive. And most fans across the continent were always having their hopes on Nigeria, because we know with their past history, Nigeria have been always performing very well at that top level. But then against Croatia, that performance was really dismal, and there must be genuine fear now across the continent that the African teams will not perform at this tournament. Remember that Morocco were beaten by Iran, a team everyone expected at least Morocco to get a result over so that they can look for something against Portugal and Spain. But now, having lost that game, then that puts them under really a much pressure. And today we've seen how Tunisia have just lost at the last minute to England, yet they'd been playing so well at that point until just lapse of concentration that led to Harry Kane scoring the winning goal for England.
For me, it's just the same old story. We keep hoping for a better campaign all the other years. It's been the same story for African teams over the years. You remember we've had issues before with Ghana, Nigeria, complaining about money. They're saying there's no money in Nigeria. It's the same old story. We just don't have what it takes to do so well at the big tournament.
We've got to look at the performance of the five teams at the World Cup against maybe those that did not qualify to the World Cup, because personally, I feel that such countries as Nigeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, they've placed themselves to at a level that they can qualify for the African for the World Cup. What will you say then about countries like Kenya that even qualifying for the African Nations Cup is always a problem?
Thank you very much. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Moscow, Russia. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Tuesday, June the 19th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloutier and Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you all a very good day, Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.